I've been listening to a book called Born to Kvetch. It's a book about Yiddish Judaism, one I highly recommend. If you want to read one book today, it's not about early
Most of
Judaism.
These people have already read Born to Kvetch, as you, I'm sure you know.
But Born to Kvetch is about Yiddish culture and Orthodox Jewish culture. And Kvetch is the word for complaining or griping. And this author, it's a beautiful kind of expose of like how important complaining is throughout Jewish history. In fact, the author has this beautiful saying that what is Hebrew prophecy but kvetching in the name of God? So there's a social justice aspect to it. We offer complaints towards society in the name of God. But then he also turns it back and shows that through a lot of Jewish history and literature, complaints towards God are very important. And you get that in the Psalms, and you get that throughout all the Old Testament. And so he offers the example of some expositions of Exodus and wandering in the wilderness. We'll interpret that allegorically in Christianity or find some moral, you know, principle to draw from it. But he straight up says it's something to complain about. Here, God, they go to God and they say, "We're hungry. You're starving us to death." And God offers them, "All right, you want food to eat? Here's some quail, and quail out the nostrils." Is that really a blessing? you know. So they're able to read some
a community overrun by quail.
Yeah, they're able to read these passages. I don't want to say lightheartedly, but with a seriousness and acknowledge that like, things suck. I was reading another Talmudic passage the other night in which Cain, the passage in Genesis where Cain turns to God and says, "What am I, my brother's keeper?" After killing Abel, and of course we read that and think, okay. What a jerk. Clearly trying to avoid the issue, he murdered his brother. But there are some rabbis who said, no, actually what he's saying is, it's your fault. Like, where were you? Mm-hmm. And they took that as a legitimate interpretation, and then God put up with it.
Right. Or another interpretation, which I find interesting, which is to not read him as being, like, facetious or something.
Yeah.
Like, it's a sincere question. What responsibilities do we have for one another?
Yeah.
But the fact that we put these in the conversation, these interpretations, like, I think we've slid into, the second major frame, maybe we did quite a while ago, which is essentially how Jews read the Bible. And we should even go further, which is like, how should we read the Bible?
Sure.
And it should be more this way.
Yeah. Yeah.
I go back to, and I hate these caricatures that are out there on this stuff, but like, when you hear critique like, this is not a rule book. No, I'm very happy that there are clear laws and directives in the Bible, and there are.
Yeah.
But to say, I think that what people begin to say that they see the Bible as inerrant or infallible, and therefore it begins to serve a function within the community that I think is actually not the way the Bible should function in the community, which is kind of like this, the thing that ends the conversation.
Yeah.
To take the Bible seriously, the Bible is the thing that begins the conversation on how we live and interact with one another in the body.
Yeah.
And I really think that's why so many people, and there are people within Center that certainly would say this is true about them, I'm sure. Like, they find the Bible to be just not that life-giving.
Yeah.
And I think it's a hermeneutical problem.
Yeah.
It actually is. It's the source for the. It's us going to a passage, whether it's Sermon on the Mount or something else, having areas of like insight and agreement and disagreement.
Yeah.
And working that through.
Yeah.
And it's not so that finally then we have now we are totally of like mind.
Yeah.
It's so that we're taking this tradition and putting it at the center.
Yeah.
Of how we try to live out our ethical and moral lives now.
Yeah.
I think it's a more interesting, and it's an endlessly deep way of handling the text.
Yeah.
What would you say about this second frame, which I know we'll spend far less time on and have already spent some time on, but what would you say about that?
Well, so as far as how Jews read the Bible, I think to summarize that point, it's to recognize that in early Judaism in the first century, this applies to Jesus, this applies to the Pharisees, they are not reading the Old Testament, and that's it. It's not as if they were a religion of the Old Testament and then we superseded that. Rather, they're a religion and a culture that interprets the Old Testament. There's actually a famous saying by Rabbi Akiva in the second century that I think illustrates this well and actually shows, again, the flexibility of the Jewish mind. And I think it applies to the New Testament era. But Rabbi Akiva's kind of teaching, and he has some disciples and other rabbis come along who accuse him of being too lax with the Torah. And the story is told that when God gave the Torah to Moses, he did not give them laws of stone, which is ironic because they're written on stone, but rather he gave them laws written on clay. The point being, as Rabbi Akiva asserts, that the Torah is meant to be changed and to be adjusted and shifted. And I think as soon as I say that, even a lot of Christians would feel very uncomfortable with that saying. But I think it goes to show that if you want a good example of Judaism not being legalistic and following the letter of the law, that's a good example. They didn't just take it as is. They did follow the letter. They paid very close attention to words. But they were willing, as I said, an eye for an eye. I don't think anybody should doubt, and especially in a kind of critical scholarly context, that means eye for an eye. It's capital punishment. You take my eye, I take yours. They were willing to say, no, actually what it means is you can provide monetary compensation, which is a much less harsh ruling. And so Judaism in the first century and in Jesus' context is not just reading the Old Testament as a straight-up manual, you know. They are interpreting it and adjusting it and applying it in various ways. And there's a methodology to that which we can get into, but
anyway. To say something that I think is a given, but I want to make sure it's explicit for our community, and that methodology should continue into the Christian practice as well.
Yeah. So let me put it this way. I think, so there's a scholar by the name of James Kugel. I'll just throw a shout out here. A book you should read is How to Read the Bible, A Guide to Scripture Then and Now.
It's an essential. Yeah. It's an essential text.
Very rich. It's
also, by the way, very readable.
Yeah. And I think it's even on Audible too. One of his books is on Audible. It's pretty good. And Kugel's main work, scholarly work, has been to explore this issue of how the ancients read the Bible. And to point out that main idea that they're interpreting things too. They have theology and they have ways of reading things. And so Kugel actually provides four kind of principles that apply to the ancient world in reading the Bible. One of those being that the Bible is fundamentally cryptic, which I think is the biggest shot. Because today, in academia and even in Christian theology, it's actually a Reformation principle, that the Bible is fundamentally easy to understand. Maybe there's a caveat that there's a right way to read it, and if you read it that right way, you can read the Bible and fully understand what God has in store.
The Reformation certainly brought out this idea that there's a plain text, plain meaning to the text.
Yeah. The perspicuity of Scripture.
Right.
I think was, yeah.
And that I think that's actually one of the more fundamental points of difference.
Yeah.
That we could identify.
Yeah.
In what is an appropriate and inappropriate way to handle the text. I am troubled by this, not because I don't want the Bible to be accessible to people.
Sure.
But I'm troubled by this because implicit is I can sit down alone with my Bible.
Yeah.
And arrive at the right insights.
Yeah.
That's anachronistic.
Yeah.
And it's incorrect.
Yeah. I think,
by the way, I think on its face,
yeah,
obviously untrue.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
I mean, for the fact that we could come up with some examples that seem like straightforward enough, even when scrutinized, are not always as straightforward as they might seem.
Yeah.
But like, let me give that point away as if that were true. Like, fine, okay. Let's say there are some things that are like straightforward enough.
Sure. Yeah.
The richness of it is realized in community and in the interaction among it within it.
Right? Yeah. So. And I don't want that to convey that like they also thought the Bible was unapplicable. Because clearly
not at
they
all
thought the opposite. but rather they came with the different assumption that because it's a divine text, we would say nowadays, well, it's cryptic because it's a composite of various books at different times. And
yeah, that would be a more modern way of thinking about
yeah.
it. Not certainly true in some ways.
Yeah.
I prefer, I think, where you're going with it, though.
Yeah, but in their mindset, it's cryptic, not just because of that fact, but because it is divinely inspired. Like, if something's sacred, it shouldn't be easy. It shouldn't be like reading... is there a word? What are the books you put on your toilet? You know, people put books on their toilet, like, for
yeah,
easy
yeah.
reading.
Yeah, toilet books.
Toilet books.
That's
the Bible is not a toilet book.
Right.
And it's also not a devotional. I mean, again, to clarify, I'm not saying moral and spiritual and devotional points weren't extrapolated or aren't even in the text. They are.
No, they were and are.
Yeah.
Right.
But
it's not merely that.
Yeah. I just fault this for the Christian publishing industry. But the proliferation of Bibles that make it easy breezy and make it feel like it's so easily accessible. And I get it. I get the impulse because you don't want to scare people away. And you also don't want to make it sound like, well, you have to be a PhD academic to understand things. That's not true. But at the same time, if something is sacred, it shouldn't be easy to come to all the time. Sometimes you have to wrestle with things. I mean, Jacob encounters God and talk about a direct encounter with God. Shouldn't that be quite simple? Well, it wasn't. Because he didn't know who he was wrestling with, and also he was wrestling
right.
and got smacked in the hip.
Right.
And so I think at the end of the day, encountering the Bible is actually like that. You will come to a direct encounter with God, but it's not always going to be fun and easy. So I could go on about that. But the first principle, the Bible is fundamentally cryptic for the ancient person. The second being that all the Bible applies to today, and we can probably sympathize with that. They shared that same view. Scholars look at passages in the Bible and think only, well, primarily in critical scholarship, this is ancient literature. It should be read in that context. Whereas Judaism, even in the day of Jesus, is thinking, well, so what if these laws of Moses are kind of antiquated? They apply to today. The third is the Bible was harmonious intertextually with its own self and with current religious beliefs. So let me kind of break that down. We as Christians also have this idea that the Bible can be read and applied intertextually. So something in Job also applies to Genesis. But they actually kind of took this to a more precise, I don't want to say extreme, but a more precise approach to say that, you know, we'll bring up Cain again. There's a rabbinic passage about Abraham, the sacrificing of Isaac. There's a question there because some of the verbiage in that passage in Genesis where Abraham goes to sacrifice Isaac is weird. And there's also repetitions. And the way they explain that is to say that, all right, here's a question. Doesn't God know everything, so doesn't he know what's going to happen? Well, there's a weird passage in there where it says, and after these things, and then it begins that narrative, they took that and they looked at it and they said, well, the word things at Deber also means words. So actually what that's saying is after these words, but there's the conundrum. There are no words. So all of a sudden the text just says, and after these words, and so they surmised probably what happened is just like what happened to Job, where Satan comes along and he starts accusing Job. And at this point he accuses Abraham and God says, you know what? Let me test him for you. And so they build this whole narrative that is not in the text. And they don't just do that out of nowhere. They do that by taking Job and Genesis, which historically are very distant. But they're fine with that because you can take one passage in Scripture and apply it to another.
That methodology now is pejoratively considered some kind of wrong-headed eisegesis.
Yes.
You're reading into the text something that is not there. Again, I have to commend How to Read the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, Kugel's work. Really what you're doing is something that is this very Jewish way of approaching the Bible.
Yeah.
This explorative, imaginative way of handling it.
Yeah.
And if you believe that it's divinely inspired,
yeah,
it's actually honoring that.
Yeah.
Because you're exploring all of its potentiality.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a humbling thing because you're living in this place of, you don't have to live in this place of total certitude.
Yeah.
You're trying to understand its richness.
Yeah. Yeah.
Trying to tap into it. You know, Rohr, again, I think really referencing Christ, I think this insight also applies to the scriptures. It's not, You know, mystery is not the unknowable, it's the endlessly knowable.
Yes.
You end up with something that in the scriptures, this is the reason I found them to be such a joy that, I mean, they certainly, to speak kind of like a-religiously about it for a moment, really do transcend the other texts that I've read in my lifetime.
Yeah.
They're just endlessly deep.
Yeah.
And it's not like you're trying to, well, you know, I've got to still make this passage relevant, you know, to kind of stay interested.
Yeah.
No, like it seems to keep giving.
Yeah.
In new ways, in new seasons of life.
Yeah.
That is not a non-Christian way of reading the Bible, but it was first a Jewish way of understanding it.
Yeah.
And accessing it. I want to say one sentence or two about, I think, something very important, because I'm just imagining those who have listened through this conversation who are saying to themselves, like, it's just not something I find myself. Mm-hmm. Or what about those people who are, like, not, you know, and I thought a lot about Smith talks about this, actually. James Smith talks about this. Like, what about people who don't have access? Like, let's think about, like, beyond, and now we're taking maybe more than a few sentences, but, like, you know, they didn't have access to the scriptures at all, or they don't have kind of the literary tools for whatever reasons. There are many.
Yeah.
I want to just say something as a word of encouragement. First, if you're able to engage these texts in these new ways, do so.
Yeah.
I know you're going to give us a few sources to do that.
Yeah.
But if you find either you know people or you realize, like, I don't know that that's, like, I'm not going to engage them in all of these ways.
Yeah.
This is the beauty, again, of a Jewish approach to reading the scriptures, and it's something that we want to see in Christianity as well. It's done in community, and what that means is your depth of relationship with Christ, your intimacy with Christ, the way you reflect his beauty and his fullness through the Spirit of God does not correlate to your IQ,
mm-hmm.
or your academic background or your intellectual discipline. Like, those things may be mechanisms for some of the people listening.
Yeah.
But, like, for the fact that we place these sacred texts within a community means that every member of the community, regardless of their dispositions, backgrounds, attributes, abilities, whatever, can represent Christ's fullness.
Yeah, well, think of who Jesus
I really think
takes.
That's important to underscore.
Yeah, think of who Jesus' disciples are.
Right.
And again, if it's true that what I'm saying, that Jesus is frankly a genius and that he's very competent in handling Old Testament texts in the same way a lot of scribes would have been, even for the fact that he wasn't a trained scribe, he comes along and teaches people who don't have any of that background.
Right.
I mean, you've got a tax collector, you've got fishermen, and to be clear, like, even in early Judaism, like, there was a scribal class, but at the same time, the rabbinic movement started to develop this idea that, like, sages could be brought from lower jobs and stuff, you know?
Right.
So really, it was just about sitting and walking and learning from, and it wasn't about passing a test.
Right.
Honestly. It was the lifelong journey of listening and exploring and even challenging things that your teacher would have said.
Right. And beginning to, and this is what I mean by, like, is saying that everyone can carry the beauty of the Imago Dei.
Yes.
What I mean by that is, like, this process. This is, again, a Jewish way of handling the divinity of the divine nature of the scriptures. Like, the process of, like, living that out,
mm-hmm.
and actualizing it through one's life,
yeah.
is available to everybody.
Yes.
And should be communally shared.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to disinterest people in pursuing some of these texts, but I just want to, like, there's a universality to our ability to, like, realize God's presence, fullness, and abundance through them, regardless of where we began or can end.
Absolutely, yeah.
So, what else on how to read the Bible?
So I'll finish out these points.
Can you give us those, like, just run down to where you were so we
yeah,
can...
Yeah, so the Bible is fundamentally cryptic. All the Bible can be applied to today. The Bible was harmonious with itself and with current religion, so they make no qualms about getting back to the historical origins or context. They have beliefs, and oftentimes they want them to fit those beliefs. You even have rabbis in the Mishnah saying, here's an explanation for our opinion, and they tie it to the text, and then some other rabbi says, But we don't even need that, because logically we could deduce from other things. So they're willing to think on their own. And then the fourth one is all of the Bible is divine. And you might think that should be first, but I think as Christians, we often start with the assumption. There's this logic in modern Christian theology. I'm not an expert on medieval or ancient church theology, but at least in modern context, we start with the Bible is fully inspired and is divine, and then draw assumptions from that. That the rabbis believed that it was also divine. Judaism also believed it divine, but they draw
they don't
completely
necessarily
different
the same
assumptions.
Things,
yeah. So, now, why is that relevant in terms of early Judaism, in terms of the New Testament, Jesus? It's because Jesus is, in early Judaism, again, to reiterate that point, they are reading an interpreted Bible. Nobody's claiming
that. And have no problem with that.
Yeah, no problem with it. That is the lifeblood of Judaism, is to interpret. And so, I want to throw out this instance of, to tie it to a particular New Testament passage, 1 John 3:10-12. So, here, the author says, "By this the children of God and the children of the devil are evident. Everyone who does not practice righteousness is not of God, namely the one who does not love his brother." Actually, namely is not in there. It should say, "and the one who does not love his brother." "For this is the message that you have heard from the beginning, that we should love one another, not as Cain, who was of the devil, or who was of the evil one, and violently murdered his brother. And for what reason did he violently murder him? Because his deeds were evil, and the deeds of his brother righteous." And I would encourage you, if you can pull up the text, that'd be great. But hopefully you can follow along as you listen. But I want to point out that at the end of that passage, in the text as it stands in the Old Testament, there is nothing about Cain being born of the devil or the evil one. There is also nothing about him killing Abel because Abel's deeds were righteous and his were evil. The passage just says that, you know, God accepted Abel's sacrifice and he didn't Cain's. And Cain gets pissed and murders him.
Right.
But the ancients had the same question we have. Like, what is going on there? Why is that such a big deal? And Kugel points out, like, they follow the text precisely. They look at words individually and try to figure things out. But at the same time, they often take it in wild imaginative directions. And here's a good case, because they look at where Eve says, as she gives birth to Cain, she says, "Look, I have begotten a man with God." That's literally what the verse says. And they said, well, that's weird. One, you don't call a baby a man, because the Hebrew word is ish,
right?
Not child,
right?
Or male.
Right.
And two, with God?
Right.
What does that mean? And so they recognize, rather than in our English translations, we kind of smooth it over.
Right.
We don't acknowledge it.
Therefore, just trying to clean it up and make it easy.
Yeah, we want to clean it up.
Again, that hermeneutical problem, as opposed to leaving it, and I mean, I know where you're going with this, as opposing to leaving the complexity, which actually probably reveals kind of some of the ways, what would be the term, like the ways we thought about, like, divine order.
Yeah.
Angelology.
The cosmos. Yeah.
The cosmos.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so they surmise that what's actually being said there is that I have begotten a man, and man is often used also for angels.
Right.
So I've begotten an angel, and it can also be read with not with the Lord, but of the Lord. And so I've begotten an angel of the Lord. And so essentially Eve had sex with Satan,
right,
or a fallen angel.
Right.
And produced Cain. And so Cain is literally the son of the devil. And you have this whole complex interpretation. And I think what you also see in John, and I haven't found other passages yet, but I would also surmise that there's another kind of interpretive thing going on, where they would surmise that the reason Cain was upset is because that his deeds were unrighteous and Abel was righteous. This is before he's murdered. And that's why he kills him. And so all of this is going on in this passage in John. And so, or 1 John, and the author here clearly is familiar with some kind of interpretive, in early Judaism we call it Midrash, that goes into his moral point. And so, and to bring that back, his point in 1 John is that those who are of children of God are those who practice righteousness and those who love their brother. And so, ties it into this whole scriptural interpretation. So that's where it's beneficial, where even if you take the time to read closely things Jesus, Paul, or the other writers in the New Testament say, you'll encounter things where you're like, but that's not in the Old Testament. How are they getting there? And right. That's where you can look at other texts in early Judaism and be like, oh, there's this whole creative and interpretive process going on. Like, do I think that Genesis actually says what's said here? No.
Right.
But they clearly did. They had an interpretive tradition.
That took them to that place.
Yeah. So.
Absolutely.
Yes. It. All right, so one more example to tie this in to why it's relevant and how we understand Jesus himself. So we're not just talking about, I don't want to make it seem like we're just talking about, hey, isn't it fun to learn how ancient Jews interpreted scripture and just as a pure academic exercise? It actually affects how we begin to read the New Testament and understand what's going on. One of those is the problem of the Son of Man. So Jesus, one of his most well-known things is that he constantly refers to the Son of Man. And I'm still a champion in terms, there's scholarly debate, but I side with those who first point out that Son of Man in the first century was a diverse term. It was a very common term, so it could just mean a regular person. It could also refer to the Daniel Son of Man, but that's usually where we stop. I actually think there's good evidence throughout earlier and later Jewish literature, so some that predates and some that postdates Jesus, to show that there is an interpretive tradition where the Son of Man refers to Abel. Okay, so you see actually Jesus using all of these. You see him talking, you have the example in Matthew where the person who's paralyzed is put down through the roof and he heals him. He says, so that you may know that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins, get up and walk. And what you see people saying as they walk away, Matthew says, they were amazed, and they said, who knew that God had given such authority to men? And so I think actually the point there is that that's the human man, not Jesus himself, but rather it is possible that humans on behalf of God can go around and offer forgiveness and forgive people. So that'd be a whole other issue. But you then have passages where Jesus is talking about his sacrifice, and I don't think it's about the Danielic Son of Man coming on the clouds to judge the world. I think it's about the Abel Son of Man, and here's why. The interpretive tradition looked at that and said, well, who is the Son of Man in Daniel? The Ben Adam in Hebrew, and I forget the Aramaic equivalent, but Baranesh, I think. The literal son of Adam would be Abel. And what happened to Abel? He was murdered unjustly, and his blood cried out. And so they looked at that, and they saw that Abel was the first martyr in human history. And so around this developed this conception that the Son of Man who would return on the clouds with glory would actually be Abel. And it would be the person who was martyred who would then was given authority to judge the world on behalf of God. And bring justice. And so I think in Jesus' conception, he also applies that interpretive tradition that the Son of Man is not just an angelic figure or divine emissary. It is in fact a person who would have to suffer and die. And because of that suffering, God would then raise him back up and give him authority. And so if you're willing to engage with interpretive traditions and not just say, well, we know that the Son of Man's in Daniel, that's it. We'll just take Daniel. But realize that actually in early Judaism, there's a whole complex network of readings that if we pay attention to, we might actually be able to understand some nuance in Jesus' own self-understanding. So his sacrifice wasn't just, because this is important, because some scholars have argued that, well, him dying on the cross was actually a fluke at the end, that later Christians interpreted as, okay, this works. I think Jesus himself, I don't think those are made up things by the gospel narratives. I think Jesus himself at some point thought, I'm going to have to die for what I'm saying. And this fits my theology because I believe that God will raise me up and give me authority for that reason to judge the world. Not because I'm God, but because I was the one who was willing to die. And so it adds much more nuance and a much more, I think, historically complex narrative. And again, shows how Jews are reading scripture in the ancient world, that they're not just pulling out a passage from the Old Testament and saying, this is what's happening, but rather it's preceded by a whole bunch of interpretation to get there. So, anyways.
Yeah, I think that I think that the more we understand Jesus in his context, in his faith system, the stranger he becomes,
yeah,
and the more compelling he becomes. Yeah. And I think that's, to me, over the years, that's been kind of a, it's, I don't know that I really think about it much, but it's just kind of this kind of way I know that I'm on the right track.
Yeah.
Like the stark differences and strangeness and otherness,
yeah,
but also the more I'm encouraged and excited and interested in this person.
Yeah.
And I don't think you get there,
yeah,
by ripping him. You don't get there by ripping, yeah, him out of his context and by ripping him out of the faith in which he,
yeah,
in which he worked and operated. And you don't arrive at that without a
yeah,
better hermeneutical, a better approach to reading the Bible.
Can I say real quick, yeah, I didn't cut this out, but the reason I think that's relevant to us individually and for everybody listening is because I think if you start to look at Jesus' death in that way, it's not the only way to perceive it, but if you look at his other remarks about being willing to die, take up your cross,
mm-hmm,
he is, if you're not willing to take up your cross and follow me, we forget that, one, Jesus didn't die for the gospel, and I feel comfortable saying that, meaning Jesus didn't go around preaching himself and saying, if you don't believe in me, then you're screwed, and that's why he died. I mean, at the very end, he did some pretty drastic things in the temple and pissed off a lot of people. And those, to me, had all to do with social justice. It's not the only thing, but I think it ties back into his own remark about keeping the Torah, because if we look at him saying, you must take up your own cross and follow me, he's already saying that before he's even crucified. But the reason he can say that is because he's not thinking of himself dying, because he can't, because he hasn't yet, right? What he's saying is, already in Jewish history, about 50 to 100 years ago, one of the Hasmonean kings had come along and crucified a bunch of Jews on crosses so that they lined up all along the row, because they were Torah observant. Sorry, not Hasmonean kings, maybe that's Antiochus. Either way, because of their Torah observancy, like, they were crucified. And Jesus is alluding back to that and saying, if you're not willing to die for the Torah, then you're not worthy to follow me. And so he's telling people to take up that cross, to be willing to sacrifice for keeping God's word, God's Torah, in the Jewish context, that he himself is also willing to keep. And in his mind, that is not just, how do we keep the Sabbath? It's also challenging authorities in the temple. It's also challenging people. You know, what he says when he leaves Jerusalem, he doesn't say, if only you had believed that I would take away the sins of the world. He says, if you had done the things that made for peace. And he cries. Because what he had hoped for Jerusalem and the Jewish people is that they would have changed. Maybe Jesus isn't revolutionary, but I definitely think he's about reform.
Yeah, I think that there's much you said there. But I think that to read Jesus as someone who is primarily concerned with heaven, hell, and the afterlife,
yeah,
is to misunderstand.
That's a better way of putting it.
No, you said it well, but it's to misunderstand
yeah,
his mission. It's really to misunderstand Christology and soteriology,
yeah,
because we're talking about, I mean, we won't, but his parables, we're talking about a kingdom coming.
Yeah.
And that is inherently interested,
yeah,
in reforming.
Yeah.
Not ex nihilo. It's not building from nothing. It's working our way back to God's good creation and God's good order.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I hope that for those listening, I mean, I hope there are people that really resonate with that, because I feel like there are people listening who are much more prone to be active and engaged in our current culture for things that they believe are just, and they want to see progress. And I don't think that has to be done separate from Jesus.
No, I've been actually concerned that the ways in which certain factions of this larger picture of Christianity have reacted to our current moment, that might encourage those who are more conscientious of these things, might nudge them away from Christianity.
Yeah.
It's a deep concern I have, because the reality is these are the times all the more that we want to affirm who Jesus was. Can you imagine giving up the ground of who Jesus was and is to those who are misrepresenting him politically or otherwise? That would be its own kind of tragedy, and it would be ignoring all of the people throughout Christian history who have suffered, sometimes at the hands of other so-called Christians.
Yeah.
And so I think we're maybe jumping a little bit. I hope everybody's tracking with my thinking on this. Let me be clear. In the ancient world, Jewish and otherwise, people were very interested in the afterlife.
Sure, yeah.
And that's another caricature that's out there. Oh, you know, the Jews didn't think about the afterlife at all. No. That was relevant.
Yeah.
Human beings think about what happens when they die.
Yeah.
That is a human question.
Yeah.
But it's very important to not reduce Jesus to, here's how to get to heaven.
Yeah.
He was interested in a kingdom coming.
Yeah.
And Paul was interested in a kingdom coming.
Yeah.
And so I don't think that's a tangent, and I think we have to see the language of Jesus near the end of his ministry and the end of his life as very, very concerned about building what God would say is good and moral here.
Yeah.
So we're certainly in agreement on that. But I think that's useful.
Yeah.
What else should we touch on?
Well, we can briefly touch on that last point if you want. Do you want to move?
Yeah, let's be completist about this. Right. The final kind of frame was Christianity and anti-Judaism.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I often think this is another good launching point into why we should study early Judaism, or why it's helpful to at least know something about it. And that's because the history of Christian theology and Christian culture, with its rhetoric, but, well, just to be clear, its rhetoric was thoroughly anti-Jewish. Not always. I mean, there were sympathizers, there were people who wanted to understand. I mean, you have the church father Jerome learning Hebrew from a rabbi. You also have early Christian movements in the first and second centuries that were thoroughly Jewish. You also have the Church of the East, which is a whole other subject, but is still thoroughly enmeshed in a Semitic context.
Mm-hmm.
So it has a totally different flavor. But in Western Christianity and European history, you often see the Jews being used, even in the current day, as a foil for Christians.
I mean, you have Justin Martyr, who, when we hear that name, we're probably thinking of just, church father.
Yeah.
But, I mean, he was saying that, I don't want to misquote, but, basically, the utility of circumcision was that so the Romans would know who to kill.
Yep.
Brutal.
It was actually used that way too.
It was in fact used that way.
Yeah.
It was in fact used that way. I mean, we won't dive down that.
I mean, there's a reason Paul said you can don't undo your circumcision, which is a real thing and thing people did.
Was in fact a thing that they in fact did.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's very early that you have this scapegoating.
Yeah, scapegoating.
Taking place.
And so, in recent history, and I think thanks to New Testament scholarship and kind of the academic world that's helped brought it about, that post-Holocaust, scholars have really come to terms with what went wrong and how we've been misunderstanding things. To be clear, what I don't want to say is that the church down the street from us here, if the pastor during a Sunday sermon characterizes the Pharisees as legalistic or Jews as legalistic, that he is responsible for the Holocaust.
Sure. Right.
That would be absurd, and I actually think morally wrong. But nonetheless, I feel okay saying that a lot of Christian rhetoric and theology still exists that is is subtly anti-Jewish. And I think it's important to start there, because anti-Semitism is a modern concept that is based around a concept of race that developed in Europe in the 1800s. Prior to that, what you had was Christian anti-Judaism, and it's a theological conception about not only has the church replaced Israel, but you start perceiving the Jews as weird and mysterious.
And Luther takes some blame for this.
Yeah, his
but
whole
it really precedes
wrapping
him.
Them in the scroll. Yeah, precedes him. But Luther's a weird example, because at first, you know, breaking from the Catholic Church, in his mind, who are going to be good allies? The Jewish people. But in his mind, that meant that they had to be Christians. And when that didn't work, he then resorts to basically saying we should wrap them up in their Torah scrolls and burn them. You have other issues which
people are taking down the pictures of Luther they have in their homes right now.
Yeah, right now. I don't know.
That giant Luther portrait, you're rethinking that, aren't you?
Luther was a crass man, but he's an interesting guy. But you also, I mean, even politically and socially, you think about how, if I remember correctly, this is not my area of expertise, but not that I'm an expert in anything, but the area I've studied less. But at least beginning in the medieval period, you have Christians relegating Jews to basically financial activities that, according to Roman Catholic law, you can't have usury, you can't have loans. Well, who do we put in charge of that? Because I'm a good Christian, I'll put the Jew in charge of that. And it creates this weird scenario where you can then use the Jews as a scapegoat for terrible things that happen. I mean, if your money lender or your tavern owner or whoever else is a Jew, perfect way to take the minority person and then blame them for all your problems. Not the feudal lord, not the state, but the Jew in the middle.
Right.
It still happens today. I mean, if part of our, for example, Republican rhetoric is to take Mexicans crossing the border and stealing our jobs. This has always been a phenomenon throughout history, where we take somebody who is the minority in this situation, who's willing to do something, but then when things go bad for us, nobody wants to work those jobs.
Right.
Nobody wants to work in those fields or live in those conditions oftentimes. And those conditions need to change, but let's just be honest that your average white guy is not going to go down and do those jobs.
Right.
So, but when times get rough, when coal mining industry goes under, or when we have hard times in the Midwest, we can look at that and use, you know, the person crossing the border as the scapegoat.
This convenient
other. And so that's exactly what happened to Jews throughout history, too. And again, buttressed by Christian theology, that the Jews murdered Jesus, even though the New Testament doesn't say that. There is some ambiguity. Again, part of the problem is that there are phrases and rhetoric in the New Testament that if you read as anti-Jewish, then you have fuel for the fire.
Right.
But if you see them as an internal conflict,
right,
that you can't use them to blame the Jews.
Yeah.
Yeah,
if you bring in those presuppositions, you'll find those passages there.
Yep.
This is not me trying to kind of do some quick kind of, let me just cleanly solve all of this. It's a complex problem that people have addressed.
Yeah, sure.
But the point is that great, like the scholars that we can, and what I mean by should, is that they've done the hard work of reconstructing these times. The people that we should trust on this are not arriving at those anti-Semitic conclusions.
Yeah.
If anything, the condemnation is often much more about class and power structures.
Yeah. No, I think that's evident there.
I mean, whether that be like those in Rome who insist on Jesus' demise, or a few members of the Sanhedrin.
Yeah. You know, as far as Christian theology, I think other examples that happen leading up to our modern experience is, again, you have an unfamiliarity, and I think this speaks loudly, that when a majority group is already using people as a scapegoat, but avoids any attempt to understand culture and conversation. You know, there are places, for example, in medieval Spain, you have Muslims, Jews, and Christians writing and arguing with each other philosophically, that is mutually beneficial.
Right.
That doesn't seem to be the dominant case throughout the rest of European history.
Right.
You have a lack of understanding and a lack of conversation, so that, for example, you can just, again, where a conception of legalism and how weird the Jews are is the Talmud is weird and complicated. And especially if you don't understand Hebrew or Aramaic. It took a while for Christian scholarship in kind of the Renaissance period to even get to the point where they would learn Hebrew. I mean, that was a new thing. So you have progress with the, you know, Renaissance and wanting to understand Greek and Latin better, bringing in the works of Plato and Aristotle. And then you have some side offshoot in the 1700s where people are starting to think, okay, this isn't just about Christian theology. Let's understand Greek, Hebrew, Latin for their own sake. There could have been hope there, I think, but it didn't achieve what it could have achieved. Because eventually then you have late 1700s, mid 1800s, basically Hebrew for a while being disregarded. And then when it's brought back in, anti-Jewish sentiment turns into anti-Semitic pseudo-scientific theory. And this wasn't just like the secular state or the German Republic. It was equally, the church was equally complicit. Scholars were equally complicit in many cases.
Yeah, I mean, so, there was a great essay that, this may now be hopefully no longer correct, but as of 2011, that anti-Jewish or anti-Semitic, again, I appreciate the distinction you made, courses were not even required of seminaries.
No. Yeah.
Those who have some educational background in these topics know that much of a master's degree in ancient Judaism or Jewish studies really only begins to put one on par, mm-hmm. if that, with somebody who has grown up in those environments with those worldviews, right?
Yeah.
Obviously more complex than the way I just situated it, but like essentially the point is at an academic, at an institutional level,
yeah.
This has not been required of seminarians in the way that it should be, this kind of awareness.
Yeah. I think many,
even though all scholarship post Holocaust is in some ways talking about the Holocaust, it's like it can't be avoided. It's a watershed moment that changed everything.
Yeah. I think that's a great point because I think even still, and it's probably more the case in probably conservative seminaries, but it is still unsettling that you might have graduates who still walk away, again, with Judaism merely as a background, as a way to help me understand Jesus for my own sake. Because I want to stress that, like, all of these things I think are enlightening and I've hopefully offered examples, but I also want people to understand Judaism for its own sake.
Right.
Because I think it's the charitable thing to do.
Right.
And I think even in doing that, you begin to understand your own... happens with any culture.
It's a comparative religion thing, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's that misunderstanding, like, oh, if I send my son or daughter into a comparative religion class, they'll convert.
Yeah.
If done well, they'll understand a different faith system and appreciate their own and understand their own with more clarity.
Yeah.
All the more so with these kind of sister faiths.
Yeah. Well, so to bring it up to kind of the modern period. Between like 1899 and 1939, you have this huge rise in anti-Semitism. So more than what had existed before. And what's interesting is that in scholarship, you can see this in New Testament. And again, I don't want this to be an ad hominem. Like, just because there may have been motivations behind a scholarly argument doesn't necessarily mean that it invalidates ideas and discoveries or arguments it makes. But one of these is actually, and you still see this, the dominant theory in New Testament studies is still that Aramaic was the lingua franca of the first century. Jesus spoke Aramaic.
Right.
Again, that may be true. But it is still nevertheless the case that part of the insidious nature of that theory was, or the motivation for arguing that early on in German critical scholarship, was to distance Jesus from a Jewish Semitic context. There were other attempts to purely cast Jesus in terms of Hellenistic Judaism. Again, we talked about Hellenistic Judaism was contrasted with Palestinian Judaism.
Right.
Because if we could do that, Jesus was less, he was like a liberal Jew.
Right.
And so various attempts to not purely just understand what the language was and what languages existed and how they functioned, but kind of an ideological underpinning to where if we can distance Jesus from this, this makes us feel better about ourselves because he's essentially not Jewish. If you think that's not that bad, by the time of the Third Reich, you have the establishment of the Institute for the Study of the Aryan Jesus, which were big name scholars.
That's interesting.
Very smart people who were legitimately arguing through critical methods and kind of revisionist historical approaches that Jesus was not Jewish at all. In fact, he was of Aryan descent. And
I'm sorry to say, you still see watered down versions of this, never that language.
Yeah.
But you see watered down versions of this now. Mm-hmm. I mean, there will be people listening that have grown up in churches where Jesus was pitted against Judaism. And I, like you were, you know, kind of hedging, you know, a little bit earlier. Am I saying that just like cleanly equates to anti-Semitism?
Sure. Yeah.
But
yeah.
It's simply untrue.
Yeah.
And these are remnants of this attempt to grab and claim Jesus for your religious system.
Yeah. This kind of just came to me. I was reading a passage, again, I'm talking about the other night, where they're talking about, it was actually in the context of interpreting the Cain passage, but they bring up the issue of Cain's blood, because they're trying to figure out, sorry, this is obtuse, that's how the rabbis work, trying to figure out if a witness lies, what do you do with him? And they say, well, Cain's, the words in Hebrew are actually Cain's bloods, plural, cry out. And so they say, because that's a, why would you include plural? They say, well, if somebody lies, actually, they're responsible for the person that dies on their because of their false testimony and their children's death that never occurred. So it's a very much more severe punishment. They're supposed to warn a witness about this before they testify. And then because of the way Talmudic literature works, it's weird and rambling, much like my conversation, they then go off and talk about Adam. And the judge is supposed to warn the witness that just so you know, because God created one singular person, that teaches us that we are responsible. If we kill one person, we have killed everybody. And if we save one life, we have saved everybody. And so they deduce this from just Adam being created, you know. And then they say, they add on another interpretive tradition which says they're supposed to tell the witness, and just so you know, just like people or kings stamp their image on a coin, God has stamped his image on us. And here's what they deduce from that. They say, kings go, to clarify, in the ancient world, just like our coins stamp
right.
our presidents, they
right.
stamp the image of the king.
Right.
And because Adam was created in the image of God, or stamped with his authority and his image, they note that, well, kings will come along and they'll stamp their image on a coin, and all those coins look the same. But God, to show his greatness,
yeah.
has stamped his image on people who look totally different. But they all share that same image. And which Jesus, side note, like, when he says whose image is on the coin, I think that actually applies there.
And this is a beautiful insight into
yeah. But
God's creation.
Yeah, so what I think is relevant in that rabbinic insight, though, is that if people being made in the image of God, the rabbis don't argue that we all need to be the same.
Yeah.
They say people are different, but we're
right.
all made in the image. And so I think a lesson for Christians today, rather than trying to be Jewish, I mean, I get people asking me all the time, why do you study Judaism? You want to be a Jew? And I'm like, no, I love being a Gentile because, like, pork is dope. Like, I don't... And,
so many possible
yeah,
titles.
Yeah, and Jews don't... Pork is dope. Jews also don't want Gentiles to be Jew, like...
Yeah, if I could interject, there are two, I think, mistaken responses to... And maybe if you've listened through, likely over the course of two podcasts, or I don't know what Kate will do with this, but if you've listened through, well, okay, fine. So, like, what are you telling us here? Like, we need to be Jewish now. Okay, so here's what Paul, in all of Paul's complexity, is saying when he comes out so strongly against there are many things he's saying. I'm going to highlight one when he comes out so strongly against Gentiles receiving circumcision.
Yeah.
Okay. It's actually weirdly still very misunderstood.
Yeah.
He is saying to the Gentiles, don't receive circumcision. Mm-hmm. Not because Paul doesn't value circumcision.
Yeah.
Paul is circumcised.
Yeah.
Paul wants Jews to be circumcised.
Yeah.
Why is he saying then to the Gentiles, don't get circumcised?
Yeah.
And why is he attacking with such, you know, with such vitriolic language? Why is he attacking Judaizers who are insisting that Gentiles do get circumcised? Because Paul believes that the kingdom of God, the kingdom of heaven, is realized when people from all nations and all tribes come to know Christ, and they're in honoring and they're in honor and love the one true God.
Yeah.
You know what subverts that? What subverts that is a Gentile who has a different ethnic background, a different philosophical system, becoming a Jew.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so what do you end up with now? You end up with some very interesting practices in some communities where it's like they're trying to become Jewish.
Yeah.
That's not what Paul is suggesting.
Yeah.
Be Jewish if you're Jewish.
Yeah.
If you're not Jewish, you're actually and following this Jewish and then cosmic Messiah.
Yeah.
I mean, you're actualizing the prophecies that Paul believed in so deeply.
Yeah.
It's a really strange, so we get these strange kinds of reactions, which is trying to divorce Jesus from Judaism or trying to become Jewish.
Yeah.
And then you get these incomplete attempts to practice Judaism.
Yeah.
In I don't know, again, the Midwest or wherever. It's like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
It's always highly selective and very weird. Like, you know, okay, so I'm not going to eat pork.
Yeah.
Is that what it takes?
and to be fair, I mean, there are points where I'm like, I've actually had a good friend out at NIAC. We were in the master program together, and he was that kind of Christian.
Yeah.
Big-ass beard. Sorry, I can't see it. Wore the tzitzit, the tassels for Jewish prayer.
Right. Jesus wore.
Super great guy. And you know what? Fine.
Yeah. Maybe these are not evil people.
Oh, yeah, sure.
It's like,
yeah
you don't want to eat pork, go for it. You want to observe in these ways.
Yeah. What is... Honestly,
but understand you're not now Jewish.
Yeah. In fact, honestly, that kind of reminds me, even Paul's concept that, you know, if you're going to do it all the way. Like, you can't just half-ass it.
Right.
I mean, that is...
that is a central part of what he said. I mean, he's quite a bit more rhetorically verbose.
Yeah. And so what bothers me more are various Christian movements, and it seems to be more of a Pentecostal thing, or at least a charismatic thing. Maybe I'm wrong on that.
Yeah, I don't know exactly where how it organizes, but I've observed it.
But it's like fetishizing certain parts of Judaism, and I'm sure it's a genuine desire, but it kind of cheapens the Jewish faith.
Exactly.
Cheapens Jesus. And again, in NIAC of all places, I mean, I constantly encountered this where people, first of all, they're like, you're from the Midwest.
Right.
Where's that? And they're like, you're a Christian? You're studying Judaism? You want to be a Jew? And I'm like, no. And they're like, what's going on? You know? And I just told them, you know, like, I guess I came to the conclusion that, like, the central figure in my religious faith was a Jew. I just want to know more about that. And every Jewish person I talked to, whether they were non-practicing or there in a few cases, a few rabbis I talked to were like, dope.
Mm-hmm.
And so, do you mind if I tell this story real quick?
No, please. Yeah.
One of my favorite moments that this has brought me was out in NIAC. I was at a bar one night and I'm sitting there talking to some people I just met and they're like, hey, you should meet this guy. He's a rabbi. And I imagine this guy was a rabbi in the same way that like a really hip progressive youth pastor is in Christianity. Cause like he's at a bar and he's like half drunk and he was pretty young. But I was, you know, I introduced myself and went through that whole scenario again. And he's like, you're studying Judaism. Why? And I told him that. And he's like, no shit. He's like, you don't want to be a Jew. I was like, no, why would I? He's like, yeah, we don't want you.
we don't want you.
Yeah.
We don't want you.
And, he was joking. He was serious, but joking.
Right. A great insight, actually. Yeah.
And then proceeded, or what followed was this long conversation where he says, why would you even do this? Because again, people, maybe it's relevant to bring up, throughout a lot of Jewish communities in history, they have not seen Jesus as Jewish.
Exactly. Back to my point. Yeah. Either people are trying to, you use the language of fetishizing, like, let's become this.
Yeah.
That's the way to become close to Christ.
Yeah.
Or let's demonize,
yeah,
you know, Judaism.
So for this...
And repurpose Christ for our own political or whatever, you know, nationalist ends.
Jews doing scholarship on Jesus is very new. And actually very astonishing. It's great. And it speaks to, like, the progress that has been made post-Holocaust. But anyways, this guy wasn't necessarily familiar with it, but he had a traditional kind of, like, I believe it was conservative. Conservative Jewish ordination. And so we start talking about it, and I start, like, some of the things I've even brought up today, we're talking about Talmudic passages, and the whole point I was trying to make to him, I was like, listen, this is Jesus. Like, I said, Jesus, at the end of the day, Jesus would be more comfortable talking to you and your rabbis, honestly, than I think he would, say, Augustine. Mm-hmm. And I'm not downplaying Augustine. I love this literature. I love church literature.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as his idiom and his culture probably vibes more with that. And he's like, well, what do you mean? So we walked through all these passages. I talked about the image of God. And I said, you know, it's in this Talmudic passage here and this passage here. I said, that conversation continues. And he's like, no shit. And then we bought a few more beers. We talked about it more. And at the end of the day, like, or night, he was so thrilled. Because I don't think he had ever talked to a Christian, at least in that way. And I walked away and I thought, well, not only did I make a good friend,
right?
Not only did I get a rabbi drunk, but we actually had a genuine, mutually beneficial conversation that I still wish there were more of today, like even for my own self.
And I think about, you know, I think there's a theme in that story, which is that, you know, as a church community, how do we want to represent Christ to those who are outside of our community, outside of our faith?
Yeah.
And, like, how do we want to experience Christ in this kind of real-time way as we're thinking about him, speaking about him, trying to, like, understand him?
Yeah.
And I think it's just a worthwhile pursuit.
Yeah.
So... this is a great conversation.
Yeah.
I appreciate it so much. I think that a good way to end, we'll make it very, very brief. Maybe you give a top, what would be fair, top three books to start with?
Three books, okay, yeah.
With something like that?
Yeah.
Or podcasts or whatever. And I'll do a top, you know, two or three as well.
Okay.
We'll keep it, you know, just kind of like, for those who are like, I've not done any intellectual work on this. I think it would enrich my experience of my faith.
Yeah.
I think it would enrich my understanding of Judaism for, as you said, for its own sake. So maybe what top three? Would that be fair?
Yeah. Why don't you give yours first? Because we may over.
Well, we got to trade off.
Yeah.
We got to trade off. I'll go. I'll start. Only three. I'll start with one because I think it's very accessible.
Yeah.
Amy Jo Levine's book. The Misunderstood Jew.
Yeah.
I love it.
Okay.
Because I don't remember how long it is. Like, it's, you know, paperback and small and less than 200 pages and readable. And you will be reading this book and you'll be like, my pastor said that at one point. I hope you will not say that I said that at any point. I hope not to make those errors. But not, and then it's not about slamming a pastor, but it's about, oh my goodness, like, oh yeah, like they said that with no evidence.
Yeah.
Like these, it just debunks so much wrongheadedness about Jesus and ancient Judaism, and it's just so accessible.
Yeah,
and really all it is a scholar who has done her work. So I'm going to start with that one, The Misunderstood Jew.
Yeah.
Your turn.
To counter that one,
okay.
I would add or recommend David Flusser's The Sage of Galilee, subtitled Rediscovering the Genius of Jesus. And so Flusser also looks at Jesus in a Jewish context. But I think kind of elucidates a lot of the things we've talked about today, too, that might complement Levine's book, too. So.
Okay. I'll give a New Testament, annotated New Testament, which is the Jewish annotated New Testament. So this is understanding the New Testament in looking at it in a Judaic, through a Judaic lens, not only is the commentary at the bottom, like, worth its weight and worth it, the cost of the book, but the essays in the back. Just to highlight a few of the essays, common errors made about early Judaism. And this is two and a half pages.
Yeah.
The law, and it's three pages or something. I mean, food and table fellowship.
Yeah.
Jewish movements of the New Testament period. Each of these are a few pages long, and that is what makes it so useful, right? Like, this is not a course that you have to take, but those essays are essential, and the Jewish annotated New Testament is my second.
Honestly, if you had to buy one book, it would be that. I think that would be the most useful book to have on hand, because it's the New Testament. You'll be reading the New Testament, and you'll find launching places for, like you said, brief summaries, and then launching places. If you want to buy these other books, then you can.
Yeah, absolutely. But, yeah. Love that one. What else? What's your second? I mean, if you use Google, it has to count.
Yeah.
Referenced them already, but it has to count.
How to Read the Bible by James Kugel. Although I want to give a caveat. This one is super thick and very dense. There is another book by James Kugel called The Bible as It Was, which is a little more approachable, I think. It's also thick. But one of those two. The same subject.
Yeah, I've not read The Bible as It Was.
Okay. The Bible as It Was focuses more on just talking about the various traditions and how Judaism read Scripture, whereas How to Read the Bible talks about modern scholarship a lot. So I hope that I'm still going to count that as second. But.
Okay. fair enough. Yes. Okay. I will not break the rules. You are, but I won't. Final one for me. This is hard because there's just a few I happen to have on the table, and all of them are very valuable. Yep. Every Man's Talmud.
Yes.
The Major Teachings of the Rabbinic Sages. This is a small book. It is, like, small as in... I don't know why that matters to me, but it's, like, very, like, you can put it in your backpack and carry it. Yep. It's very portable. It's, like, you can read for 5 minutes and really take something away. You can read for an hour.
Yeah.
That's very, very useful. It's going to... it's going to add so much texture to how you think about the New Testament, about Jesus, and about Judaism. So Every Man's Talmud would be my final, even though it's hard to do just three. So your final one?
My final one, I'm going to go back to the one I've already mentioned, which is Born to Kvetch.
Okay.
I've
not read it, so I'll put that on my list.
I just want to throw one in there that's not New Testament related or early Judaism. This is, you know, looking at Yiddish, looking at contemporary Judaism and Hasidic communities. And really, like I said, gives a funny, a humorous, and honestly at points just an enlightening look at Yiddish culture.
Love it.
So, yeah.
Cameron, great to talk with you.
Thank you. It's good to talk.
It's been really interesting, and I have no doubt it will be edifying for our church and our community.
Yeah.
And I hope they have great conversations around it. Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you.
See you next time, church.